Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism. I'm Pat Donahue. I'm here with C Money Burns and Dan Goldsberry, back from the forest. Actually, he was back last time. How's it going, guys?
Not too shabby. How are you doing?
Not bad, not bad.
What's up, yo?
So on this episode, we have an interview with Muad Herezi, who is running for Congress in Connecticut's 1st District. He's rather young, but he's got a lot of bright ideas, and we focus the interview mainly on Medicare for All and improving our healthcare system in the U.S. Speaking of improving our healthcare system in the U.S., there have been a couple bills on the table here, namely the infrastructure bill and also the giant reconciliation package that could potentially have some effect on our healthcare system. Any word on how those bills are doing?
Well, before we talk about those, I feel the need to talk about Mike Crapo. Does everyone know Senator Mike Crapo? That's a real senator. It sounds like I just made that up. But when I was researching this, it was like, well, we now go live to Senator Mike Crapo of Idaho. And I was like, oh, that's a real dude. So, and I looked at him and his white self was like, no, that's my name, guys. So anyway, he's one of the jamokes who was like trying to prevent the debt ceiling from being raised. Are you guys following this? That's only 10 days away. And McConnell's basically like trying to pull a 2010 exercise here.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, can't the Democrats just force it, like ram that shit through?
They should be able to. They're making claims that they're not going to do it themselves. And it's just so silly because it's money that's already been spent, already been allocated. It's not like what it sounds like. It is just such a ridiculous move. Like, it really makes us look, it should be embarrassing for any legislator to even bring up that as a concept.
Yeah, it's tantrum throwing. It's made to make the Democrats fail.
It smells like a steaming pile of crapo to me.
Yeah, and Crapo should be a little more concerned with the fact that they don't have hospital beds right now in Idaho and they can't find anything to treat COVID patients. Like, they're in real dire straits.
Yeah, they're like rationing care, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Could potatoes somehow help?
I'm not sure. I mean, no, I don't think so.
You just slice them thin and lay them, like, you just lay them out.
You're going to like MacGyver a ventilator or two out of them?
Yeah. Just leave the skin on, though.
You think so?
Always skin on.
Oh, yeah.
Much more flavorful.
Anyway, when Biden ran for office, he talked a lot about lowering the Medicare age, the age of eligibility for Medicare. And I was pretty disappointed in some early speeches when he just did not bring it up again. It sounds like there's some elements of this $3.5 trillion reconciliation package that could have these effects. Have you looked into this, Dan?
Yeah, well, what the bill, Bernie's bill, we need a better term than the $3.5 trillion bill, because
I think they call it the BBB, like the Build Back Better bill.
Yeah, that's right.
Don't they? That's the catchy marketing name for it.
I find that entire phrase to be not catchy and quite annoying, but let's go with it. The Build Back Better bill.
I'll put air quotes around catchy.
Well, I'm thinking just to use one not so small example, like with COVID, right? Like lowering the age to 60, which this bill does call for. Imagine how many folks approaching sort of like, you know, last third of their life or whatever you call the period right before Medicare are going to have effects from COVID or, you know, just this ongoing crisis, spending time in the ICU. 62.8 million people are on Medicare right now. And I have a feeling that there's going to be millions who are going to need it desperately in the next 5 years. I don't think this pandemic's going away.
Right. And it didn't take long for healthcare companies to stop covering COVID costs. So we're already seeing people end up with huge bills that weren't expected because early on, a lot of the COVID expenditures in the hospitals that patients incurred were being covered by healthcare companies. So I think that's a great point, Dan, that, you know, all the after effects, the long COVID or some of the crazy things that we don't even know are going to happen to people who've suffered from COVID are going to need to be covered. And so if we can get that group on Medicare, we have a much better chance of actually treating those patients.
And this is not at all sexy, but neither is Bernie Sanders. The idea of it does cover dentures, but dental, hearing, and vision, which are some of the most often deferred types of care, because they're so freaking expensive, right? Like if you have a crown, people are always like, I'm going to go get a crown done. And I'm like, what does that even mean? But it sounds terrible. It involves some drilling.
It's terrible. I have one, and it was like one of my worst dental experiences, aside from having my jaw wired shut.
I thought maybe it meant that like the dentist came out and blessed you at one point.
No, nope.
Like you've been kinged
with an enormous bill. They bless you with a big
right. So why would anyone, like if you're a low income senior, and there are so many, by the way, in all of the Trumpy states, right? How many low income seniors are there in West Virginia? Right? How many are there in Alabama? How many are there in Mississippi? Why would you go to the dentist if it was going to be $3,000? Like you just, you know, get it extracted or you don't go at all. And that leads to a lot of other like, you know, bad infections and stuff like that. So that's kind of buried in the bill, but that's huge. If I don't think it's going to be covered 100%, but anything that defrays that cost.
That's just like spending money to save money down the road because it's preventative costs, like you're saying. Like these turn into bigger issues, like an abscess can turn into sepsis down the road.
Right,
it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I don't know that I see it happening, but it would be awesome if it did.
Well, one of the things that it needs to do is it needs to reimburse at a competitive rate. And that's one of the issues with state Medicaid programs and dental coverage is that dentists won't take it because it doesn't reimburse at a rate that makes sense for them to do. And that's the kind of stuff that makes me think we really just need to scrap the system and turn it over to a new type of system so that you don't have this patchwork and you don't have doctors and dentists who are trying to decide like which insurance am I going to take, which insurance am I not going to take. You know, you got to just have everybody covered, everyone in.
And yeah, that was the thing that I like that you talked about with Muad was Medicare negotiating drug prices and, you know, standardized service prices for all medical services, whether it's for Medicare covered people or people who are covered by like private insurance or other forms.
No, standardizing pricing and getting all pricing, like let's say hospital costs on some type of list. It would be enormous, right? So it's so variable and people are always shocked or surprised. And even the insurance companies don't know what's going on sometimes when, you know, you have one procedure that ends up costing $12,000 at one hospital, at another hospital, another part of the country, for some reason it came out at $4,000, right? So like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. And there's no reason why we can't standardize those types of costs.
Yeah, it's nuts. And it's a juggernaut. I'm looking here. Medicare spending has been growing, year over year at a rate of about 6%. And it's the most recent figure I see is 2019. There's got to be a 2020 somewhere. But $799 billion, that's a big-ass market. And in a little bit of a side note, did you guys hear that as one of the parts of the Biden vaccine mandate that they're now withholding Medicare payments from hospitals that don't have a fully vaccinated staff?
Wow.
So I have a buddy who works at Mass General, biggest hospital in, I think, in New England, definitely in Boston anyway, 12 floors, many thousand, you know, a couple thousand patients, many thousand staff. And they're, you know, they're basically, the people have an ultimatum because that giant of a hospital was like, hold up my Medicare money. What'd you say now?
Right.
Well, that's what I think is so brilliant about his plan is so many of these, far right conservative people think that they're going to be thrown in some sort of like unvaccinated gulag or something like that. Or that there's going to be, some sort of like police state type repression. And it's like, nah, Joe's a neoliberal. It's going to be, sanctions. It's going to be put on private business to enforce by firing people. And ultimately, I think that's going to be a lot more effective than kind of a strong-armed authoritarian response.
Yeah, I'm all for letting the market play out. Like, let's say hypothetically, you being unvaccinated makes you like a smoker, right? Like, you can pay higher rates every year. I'll pay the lower rate. I'm cool with that.
I think eventually that's what you're going to see with insurance is they're going to say, if you're unvaccinated, we're going to actually limit coverage or we're actually going to treat it like a pre-existing condition and totally not cover any, COVID-related costs if you weren't responsible enough to get the vaccine. That seems like a logical next step.
Right. Totally. That sounds like some great free market at work.
C-Money, you had, when we were bouncing around some ideas for this episode, you had mentioned that you saw some parallels with Truman's fight for a Medicare for all, for, a single payer healthcare system. What was that parallel that you saw?
Well, I liked how you had asked about the role of unions and single payer / Medicare for all, and you bring up the union leadership labor split on the issue in Nevada. And I think it brings up an issue that's not talked about in pro-labor circles nearly enough right now, namely that unions can't and more importantly shouldn't survive on negotiated health care costs, because in employer-sponsored health insurance expanded dramatically in World War II due to like wage controls. Truman had proposed a public health system in 45, which was very popular but vocally opposed by like doctors associations and chambers of commerce, and unions just decided that the battle against that kind of capital was too costly, so they sided with employer-funded union negotiated health insurance. And then, when the War Labor Board declared that fringe benefits weren't taxable, there was an explosion of fringe benefits at the expense of real wages. And even though it was meant to be like a temporary wartime thing, it ended up coming into law in 1954. It just shows you kind of the power of capital to plow over that stuff.
Right. And you make a good point about how I think unions at this point, especially like when we saw that Nevada debate, the reason that unions were coming out in favor of their health insurance is, like you mentioned, they negotiated it. It's a huge perk and it's a huge recruiting tool. It's a huge way to get people into their union. And I think we just need to make the case to workers that, if our healthcare is, single payer provided by the government, that's fine. We still are going to need unions to fight for better wages, to fight for better working conditions. We need to show that the unions do a whole lot more. And I think that, like you say, they've been kind of dependent upon this idea that they can demonstrate that they can negotiate a much better healthcare package for their members than, without a union, which is true.
Yeah. I mean, it frees unions up to do other stuff, to, check out other concerns workers have to make their lives better, if anything.
Bernie had that exact answer. I don't know if you remember, it was during one of the debates, and it was a great answer because the argument they try to use against Democrats on this is like, well, you're going to anger the unions. And somebody basically asked that question, and Bernie was like, well, if you take healthcare off the table, you can negotiate a fair living wage. But I mean, it's basically like,
that's one of your best Bernies you've done.
That's a good Bernie.
Yeah. That's the top 2% of the top 1% of the Bernies. it's so true. Like, so many people are like, Pat, like on your paycheck, I want to say for our family plan, they want to say the city of Boston, their coverage aspect of it, whatever it is, 70, 75% is 10 grand. And they're sure to put it like on every stub, even though it has nothing to do with, like, I don't pay anything on it. They're just right. Like, just so you know,
yeah,
you know, the mothership is watching, you know? And I'm like, I get it. Like that it maybe is what you pay, but I don't know that I would leave the position if, you know what I mean? If I didn't get that rate, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I don't want to pay 100%, but I don't know that them bragging, we overpay for health insurance, if that's like a selling point.
I've never been part of a union, and you guys have. I mean, is that like one of the big things for you guys, is the negotiated benefits like that?
Oh, it's definitely nice. I mean, for instance, in our system, you add a kid, which I've done now 4 times. And once you're on a family plan, you don't pay a higher rate. And that's like unheard of in the private, you know, for-profit world, right? Like you could never find that at any normal company where you're working. So it's huge. There, you know, in our supplemental dental coverage is like, you know, off the charts in terms, like I had my dental hygienist was like, I've never seen anything reimbursed at this rate. She's like, you've got a good supplemental.
Well, on the other side of that, like what would you be looking to your union for if that was all taken care of?
Well, there's plenty, you know. It's like during COVID, they wanted to just throw us back in there right off the bat. Like we had to negotiate every single time they wanted to start school back up, and we didn't feel safe. Or, you know, you look at what we make against teachers everywhere else in the country, it's one of the best rates of pay because of the strength of our union. So there's so many ways that unions fight for us. And, you know, to be honest, teachers unions fight for students all the time too. It's not simply that they're fighting for teachers. They, because of union involvement, our kids have it better than they would otherwise.
It's also a good backstop. Like if, for example, at my school right now, students are streaming in. And right now I'm the person who helps enroll the new students. I have 4 that have started this week, and I have another 10 in the queue. So at a certain point, I can override it and put 32 or 33, but then the teacher who's aggrieved, it's literally called a grievance. And it's basically arbitration, I think, right, Pat? I mean, basically the union has a lawyer and they're like, what the fuck? And the school's like, and it's not even the principal.
That's what the letter says. They just send a letter with that.
My assistant principal, who's my boss, she was like, Dan, no kidding, right? Like, she's not like disagreeing, but like I bet you if I got her like off the record, she'd be like, yeah, I want them to file a grievance. But I'm saying that's sort of supposed to be the last resort, but it's like there's a rule, but there's also an enforcement mechanism because no teacher I know is going to hire a lawyer, right? Like there's, it just doesn't make sense. They're going to suck it up and wait for inevitably in an urban setting, 2 or 3 kids will leave at some point, right? For better or worse. So they'll just sort of ride it out, but that's fucked up because, you know, post pandemic, 34, 35 kids, learning needs, English language learners, the whole shebang. They all sort of need their own little thing. You know, they all need their own education.
Their academic stamina right now is so low. So have been in a giant class like that, it's just going to make it very difficult for them to learn anything. Sorry, go ahead, Simone.
I was just going to say, so are you saying like if your union didn't have to pay so much attention to healthcare costs, they'd be more responsive to issues like that?
No, they are responsive. And we're just giving you a list of things that they do that aren't, okay. That doesn't fall in that healthcare bucket. And it's a lot.
Well, and my question would be like that $10,000 figure, I believe it's real, but it sounds super inflated because I probably pay another $4,000 or $5,000 on top of that. Right. So that $15,000, I'll bet they wouldn't give us that whole amount back. So, and I'm not saying maybe they shouldn't, you know, you can make an argument, hey, these teachers are making good money already, but I'll bet you, my question would be if there's $15,000 in savings, what does the worker end up seeing? I don't know. It wouldn't be the full amount.
Right.
Anyway, this is a lot like we're talking a lot of capitalism here.
Well, we're talking about how unions mitigate the negative effects of capitalism.
There you go.
But stick around and check out this interview with Mawad Herezi. We got down into the weeds and talked about a lot of things that would improve and a lot of problems that exist now that they could be wiped out if we had a single payer healthcare system. Our guest on this episode is Mawad Herezi. He's running for Congress in Connecticut's 1st District. He's a former Senate staffer, an educator, and a track coach. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Mr. Herezi. We're excited to have you on the show.
Excited to be here, Pat. Thank you for having me. Really pumped to have this conversation.
Yeah. So could you introduce yourself to our listeners to start? And really, with that question, answer, like, why are you running for Congress?
Yes. My name is Mawad Herezi. I'm 26 years old and I'm running for the United States House of Representatives. A lot of people kind of get shocked when they hear how young I am. And they say, you know, why do you feel like you're qualified to run for office? And my response is, you know, I've lived 26 short years thus far, but I've seen enough to make me absolutely confident that we need a change in how things are being run. My confidence comes from the fact that I worked as an advisor to U.S. Senator Chris Murphy for about 3 years. Working on everything ranging from healthcare to foreign policy. And what I saw while working in Congress was absolutely shocking. I saw our government and system captured by corporations and big money interests. You see it in every single facet of our government. And it's absolutely, you'd have to be willfully ignorant to miss what's happening. But trying to make a difference and trying to be a public servant was really frustrating and disillusioning because I was not able to kind of bring about the change that I wanted to and that so many people want. When you have popular opinion on your side and you're still unable to even get a conversation sparked on certain topics, you start to kind of lose faith in the system. But I didn't lose faith in the system entirely. What I decided was I quit my job and I knew that the key was, at least one of the keys was electing more members who are not beholden to corporate interests, who don't take PAC money. But I'm not somebody who says, you know, just vote and then forget about things. I think we really do need a actual movement where folks are not just taking a moment to get involved in politics, but that they realize it's kind of a full-time gig and that you have to always be paying attention to what your leaders are doing. And as somebody who kind of has that spirit, I hope to kind of get involved in Congress and bring that activism from protest into Congress. And I think we see the power of that with folks like Cori Bush AOC and other leaders who have brought a real a kind of jolt of energy into Congress and these really, I think, popular ideas. So that's a bit about me. I'm running because I think it's time to get regular people into Congress. We're going to fight for us.
Great. I love that answer. And you actually kind of answered my next question, which is anytime I have a candidate on, I like to ask them up front, are you committed to being a grassroots candidate? You said you're not taking PAC money, but you are making that commitment.
Yes, absolutely. So I think the best way to govern is to listen to the people closest to the problems. And for me, that would be the people in my district and not, you know, necessarily corporate leaders or, you know, even nonprofit leaders. We still have a nonprofit industrial complex that takes a lot of money from corporations. But yeah, just listening to everyday folks, I think you tend to get really a lot of insight into the real problems and the best ideas of how to solve them tend to come from people who are facing them. So I think there's no better way to govern than to be a grassroots leader. And that's how I plan to serve if elected.
I mean, from a voter perspective, who do you want representing you? Someone who represents you or someone who's beholden to big money? That's a great way of framing that. So I see that you're endorsed by not only Marianne Williamson, but also Dr. Batista, founder of the Connecticut Coalition for Universal Healthcare. Why do you support single-payer healthcare? And what would it mean to the people of Connecticut's 1st congressional district if we were able to get it passed?
Yeah, one of my areas of passion is healthcare and making sure everyone has access to it. And this interest was ignited from my own personal experience. When I was about 17 years old, I was delayed healthcare treatment at an emergency room while I was unable to breathe and collapsing, just because my parents owed about $20,000 of medical debt because my mom had an unplanned kidney operations because she had kidney stones, something that I think many Americans know is relatively commonplace. A lot of people get kidney stones in America. So my dad was an executive at a company and still we couldn't afford it. I went in a few months later without knowing that my parents had this medical debt and was interrogated and scrutinized as a 17-year-old about how I was going to pay it off and then told to wait on the sidelines. And so kind of seeing that and having that moment of realization that I was being discriminated against left a lasting impression on me. And it made me realize that, the world's wealthiest country should not be doing this, that we definitely have the resources, but something had gone really wrong in our system. And I kind of followed the breadcrumbs and quickly realized that you, if you want to solve this and it isn't solvable, it's by doing it through the political system. And I quickly realized that if you look at single payer systems, they're a lot more equitable and can be a lot more effective. And I think there's a lot of myths surrounding single payer systems. And I always tell people, if you don't like maybe what other single payer systems are doing, don't worry. I truly believe that the world's wealthiest country can do it even better. There's a lot of benefits to it. And I've become really fascinated with the idea. And I think that people in our district, people across the country, people across the state, they know that this is something that makes sense. The polling is incredible on this. It's one of those things that kind of frustrated me in Congress is that it polls super well. Everyone loves the idea, but you can never get a conversation even started on it. Yeah, I think people in my district would love the idea, just the same way that vaccines right now are available free of cost, that you can walk into your physician and not worry about how much is this going to cost me. Right now, I'm uninsured, and that's usually the biggest question that I have, is how much is something going to cost me? You usually can't even figure that out. But the system is absolutely Byzantine and convoluted, and it drives people insane and is actually like hurting us. In so many ways, whether it's through our health or through our economy.
Right, and we're paying more per capita than systems that are working quite smoothly. So your argument for single-payer healthcare includes an argument that I try to make, but I don't see often enough, and that is the potential boon to entrepreneurs and small business owners if Medicare for All would pass, right? So that is the freedom to leave your job and start a new one without worrying about gaps in coverage, or a small business owner who has three employees but worries about employing them full time because then they'd have to pay for their health insurance. So what do you think would be the result on small businesses and new business ventures if we're able to pass a single payer healthcare system?
Yeah. And I'll even say that, which I didn't add before. After my kind of healthcare debacle at the emergency room, I studied public health and health policy specifically for 4 years in college and then worked for Chris Murphy for 3 years, kind of looking further into the system. So I consider myself, a beginner expert on this issue. I love the fact that you're bringing this topic up. Medicare for All would actually be a huge boon to the economy and would absolutely unleash, I think, small business power. As somebody whose first job was a healthcare startup, I kind of launched this company with maybe five or six friends. I quickly realized that I didn't have health insurance and had really no way to access it for the first month because I lost my insurance after graduating. It didn't even occur to me that was going to be the case. But thankfully, Pennsylvania had expanded a strong marketplace, and I was able to get online and get that accessed. But there's a lot of people that can't access it depending on what state you're in or depending on what income level you're at. I was making so little money that I actually got my insurance for free, which makes little sense because if I made just a little bit more, it actually would have been out of reach. And so the system is, like I said, designed in a really complicated way and actually doesn't work efficiently. If you had Medicare for All, I wouldn't have to worry about quitting my job. I've had a really great idea of how to make a better product or a better service. That's usually one of the biggest concerns is if you have a family, you have a couple of kids, you can't just quit your job overnight. And if you are a small business owner, you're typically worried about how you're going to provide insurance to your employees. That cost can weigh heavy on somebody's conscience, but also on their bottom line. So I think if we're just able to kind of free up our entire economy and say, healthcare is taken care of, healthcare prices and costs are taken care of by the government, then I think it allows businesses to operate in the lane that they're most effective in, which is running a business and not running a health insurance company. I think it would be a tremendous boon.
That's a great point. In terms of like kind of mental capacity and operations within the business, you remove that need for, you know, an HR department to be figuring out which plan works best for our employees and all that. That's a great, I hadn't even thought of that aspect of it. So we need to lower prescription drug prices. They've run out of control since the 1980s, but more recently we've seen ridiculous increases in things like EpiPens. So how do we get this done? Like I've heard a number of politicians talk about it. Trump, of course, paid lip service, but you know, obviously didn't get anything done on it. But where do we start with drug prices?
Yeah, I really think that there's a lot of ideas that you can deploy when it comes to lowering drug prices. The one that's gained the most prominence within the progressive movement is having our government negotiate on behalf of everyone. So having, you know, Medicare negotiate on our behalf, which I think is a great idea. And other countries have adopted that. And I think, you know, that is probably one of the strongest ideas out there. So how that would work is that even if you're not on Medicare, Medicare would negotiate for your drug prices. And so if you have an Aetna plan, then Aetna can see the price that Medicare got for everyone in the country. And, you know, if it can get lower, then great. If not, then that's the Medicare price. And if you're somebody who doesn't have insurance, then you get that same price that Medicare negotiated. So it would essentially create a cap for those prices, which I think would be extremely beneficial to our country. And, you know, pharmaceutical companies love to say that, you know, hey, I need the money for R&D. But every time we kind of examine what they spend their money on, we find out that a lot of it goes to administrative pay and marketing.
Stock buybacks as well.
Stock buybacks. So a lot of things that aren't research and development, which is where we want our money to go. I think also the government can create, this is literally a somewhat novel idea. I don't think too many people discuss this, is create a threshold where the pharmaceutical company has to spend a certain amount of dollars on strictly research and development. That way, we also are making sure that the money we're paying to pharmaceutical companies is not just being wasted on, you know, lavish parties or executive pay, because it is absolutely important that we develop these you know, life-saving drugs. That's why we're investing so heavily in a pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, we allow for them to have patents for 20 years because we want them to have these dollars to invest. So, you know, I think if we're going to give a company a monopoly for 20 years or even longer sometimes, then they have to be using that money in a wise manner.
So it's like your idea is similar to the provision of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that says that only, 20%? It has to be 20% of premiums are no more than 20% can be realized in profits. Is that it? I just totally bungled that.
So it's medical loss ratios, which say that 80 to 85%, I believe, has to be spent on the actual benefits. So you have about 15 to 20% that can be spent on whatever the company wants. But essentially says that our healthcare dollars have to be spent on healthcare. I think the same way our pharmaceutical dollars should be spent on developing pharmaceuticals, at least the majority of them. You can play around with that number. What do you want to be? We want pharmaceutical companies to make money, and you know, we want executives to feel some sort of incentive to create these drugs for sure. But we don't need an industry that is absolutely kind of sucking away all the profit and not using it wisely and continuing to accelerate the rise in healthcare costs without actually giving us back something that we need.
I like it. I like that idea. So thinking back to the 2020 presidential campaign in Nevada in particular, labor unions were mentioned by the mainstream media to be against universal single-payer healthcare. Purportedly, this was because they had phenomenal health insurance through their unions. But in a conversation I've had with an organizer, Healthcare Now, this was aired on our show in February, our listeners learned that union members tend to actually support single-payer, and it's only the union leadership who are sometimes against it. You know, you can think of it as a recruiting tool for their union. So how would single payer be a good thing for organized labor specifically?
Yeah, that's a great question. So from what I understand is that when it comes to organized labor and unions, they do receive, honestly, really kind of platinum health insurance. So they do receive really strong insurance. And the concern was a lot of it was coming from the leaders of these unions and labor. And their concern was that, and even their members had some of these concerns, which is that if we take Medicare for all, then whoever the corporation is might take those benefits back. We've paid in a lot of our salary to have these really good benefits for the rest of our lives. If you take those away, then how do we know we're going to get back the money we invested? And I believe Bernie wrote into his Medicare for All bill that that money would have to actually be given back to the unions. So if you paid, you know, $20,000 a year for this health insurance, then you'd have to get that back, whether, you know, the company could provide it through a direct payment, some other benefit, but that money would have to go back to you. So I think there are definitely ways that you can assuage those fears and concerns, those real fears and concerns that labor has, and I think rightfully has. But I think that they would understand that Medicare for All would be just as good, if not better. Most likely would be better if implemented properly. And I think it helps labor and unions because they're negotiating for so much when they're negotiating, but they should not be negotiating for healthcare. Like, they need to focus on negotiating for their pay and other forms of benefits that they might want. But if we take this off the table, it actually gives them more bargaining power and removes a tool for coercion that a company might have, which is, you know, we'll take away your health insurance.
It's a great point. I'm in a union, the Boston Teachers Union, and as you said, we have great healthcare. But if that were not on the table, then negotiations could focus on working conditions and pay. So your campaign website, I really enjoyed it because it's like a Medicare for All myth-busting website, right? So I wanted to ask you about one thing, and that is one of the biggest concerns I hear about Medicare for All or some similarly conceived single-payer health system is that it would kill jobs, especially jobs in the health insurance industry, right? So we've talked about it being a boon to entrepreneurs, small businesses, but here we're focusing more on the health insurance industry. Your website says that Medicare for All would create jobs in healthcare. How's that going to happen?
So Medicare for All, and this isn't me saying, this is, you know, experts who have run projections, would actually, you know, grow our economy because of the small business effect, because of efficiencies in healthcare and reducing the fact that we spend 1/5 of our economy on these healthcare costs. So it would grow our economy, but also it would provide a lot more healthcare jobs because a lot more people have access to the healthcare system. So think of the millions of people in America right now that are uninsured or underinsured that can't access the treatment that they need, whether it's myself who has not gone to a PCP in years now, or, you know, the fact that I have an ankle injury that I haven't treated because I can't get an MRI scan. But there are services that I've required that I've been unable to utilize. So given the fact that if I could utilize them, I would, because, you know, they are medically necessary, that would increase the need for nurses, technicians, janitors, the entire healthcare system would grow to a size that is appropriate to serve the population as a whole. So that there would be a really big increase in healthcare service providers and kind of those wraparound services. And now, when it comes to health insurance specifically, what some people don't know is that Medicare actually does not do all the adjudication for these health insurance claims. They have private health insurance companies kind of run those claims. So the difference is that Medicare will set your prices and say, you know, it's all free. We'll take it from you at the end of the year through taxes. And, you know, we're not going to charge you astronomical premiums and deductibles and all that stuff. And instead, we'll pay, you know, a health insurance company, say Cigna, a small amount to run your claims, which is really simple. It's not super complicated, but obviously that will hopefully bring down, and will bring down the executive pay and all kind of all these overpricing that happens in our health insurance industry. So it would actually even provide some more jobs to health insurance providers.
Right. So you give everyone access to the healthcare system. They're now using it the way they would have wanted to all along. And now you're meeting that demand with new workers. I like that.
Yeah. I think most people, you know, in the same way, most people aren't necessarily thrilled with their insurance company. You know, they don't really love them. They love their provider. I think most people who, you know, I have a lot of friends who work in the insurance industry because it's a lot of it's headquartered here. I don't think they necessarily are, you know, giddy every day to go wait or work for Aetna. I think if their job for IT was in Aetna or in Hartford Healthcare downtown, because there's an expansion of jobs, I think they might even be more happy, to be honest, to work at Hartford Healthcare, to kind of be in a place where you're providing a real tangible benefit to the local economy. So I think people would be excited about new opportunities because our local economy is in some ways dominated by insurance industry and who always keeps our district kind of coerces us because of the fact that they do have a footprint in here and kind of keeps us hostage by telling us that they'll always leave. It's kind of like an abusive relationship where every 5 or 6 months, if our state government wants to do something to expand access to healthcare, you know, make health insurance more affordable, we get a couple of op-eds from executives who say, you know, if you do this, we'll leave. And so this campaign is also about saying, we'll look you in the eyes and we'll dare you, go leave. You know, we think that if you don't want to be a part of our community, then that's on you. We'll create the jobs throughout the economy and other places. And I think people will be happier.
I'm familiar with Connecticut because my dad is from the Hartford area and my mom is from Waterbury. So I've been long told these stories of big companies moving out of Connecticut and kind of some of the damage that's caused. So last question on healthcare, and I'm really impressed with your knowledge on these issues. You seem to know this stuff inside and out. And so I'd like to ask this question of kind of a perennial debate I have among fellow leftists, and that is, can we reform the system, move to a Medicare for all type program without removing the profit motive, right? So Mike, one of the fears I have is that, you know, Obamacare is one example of this. It is changing some of the existing laws, making it a more fair system, but not actually removing that profit motive. Can we still achieve a system that is equitable and accessible to all without kind of removing that profit motive from the system?
Yeah. And this is, you said, even if we pass Medicare for all, like
there's still concerns. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's a fair point. I think reasonable people can disagree about how to reform the entire healthcare system as a whole, because most people don't realize Medicare for all just touches insurance. You still have, like you mentioned, pharmaceutical industry, you have hospitals, you know, you have long-term care facilities. So you have providers in general, and insurance is just kind of one of the maybe three or four big legs on that stool. So I personally tend to think that the profit motive is not it can actually be beneficial. I think having some profit in the system can help people, incentivize people to work hard and try to provide the best services possible and to go through a lengthy process of medical school, which can be really arduous. You know, some of these specialists will go through, you know, 6-7 years of residency where it's absolutely grueling work. So I think profit isn't as a kind of concept inherently bad. I think it really just comes down to how much profit is being made. Is it exploitative levels of profit? Is the public getting what it needs out of this like, you know, relationship, or is it our providers or, you know, pharmaceutical companies taking advantage of us? And I think that's the entire job of the government. Like, even, you know, move outside the scope of healthcare. The government, in a way, the way I like to think of it, one of its most kind of essential services is being like a public lawyer or public guardian. You know, anytime a really powerful corporation tries to take advantage of us, the government should step in and say, I don't think that this is fair. And this is the relationship I think that should be happening right now. I don't think the profit motive is going to be, like, you know, extremely problematic. Now, it could be, and if that's the case, I think that's when the government should step in. But Medicare for all would be helpful because it's really good at constraining costs. If you look at private insurance, which is the entire point of insurance, which is another reason why I think we you know, private insurance industry is doing a terrible job, is insurance is meant to kind of rein in costs or keep them at a sustainable level. But if you look at the level of healthcare costs that private insurance companies have, they are much, much higher than Medicare and Medicaid. So I think that Medicare will hopefully bring down the cost, bring down like kind of the skyrocketing profits that are occurring right now in healthcare that I think are a little unreasonable. But that would be my perspective.
Right. And on that administrative cost side, I've seen it, you know, like we talked about, Obamacare says nothing more than 20%. It's usually around 18, 19%, but a public program like Medicare, Medicaid is usually around 2-3% of money spent on administrative costs. So you're right. There's a lot of room there for services to get better for people, for profits to shrink.
Yeah. And I'm sure you've seen things like where, you know, hospital will charge you like $20 for a Band-Aid, like a single Band-Aid or something, you know, so that type of profit is unfair. It's definitely exploitative. So I think that the devil's in the details, and there's just a lot of kind of fluff in profits right now that's happening in healthcare. And I think Medicare would say, you know, cut this crap out. Like, this is, you can't charge me. You can't charge us this amount for a Band-Aid or, you know, using a pillow or something. I'm sure you've seen some of these receipts on Twitter or public, and they're, you know, they're just ludicrous, which you see yourself being charged for.
So would, in addition to Medicare for all negotiating drug prices, would you want some type of standardization of hospital costs, procedural costs, that type of thing as well?
So Medicare already has that. They have kind of a system they update yearly of what they will allow you to bill them for. And they have, you know, geographical variations based on metro areas and costs there. So Medicare has a really sophisticated system. It's tinkered every year. So there's a lot of detail there, but I think it does obviously a much better job than private insurance. So continuing down that path would probably be a good idea. And Medicare is also, it is completely sophisticated. They have an entire kind of section that is meant for innovation, where you can kind of bring ideas to Medicare. And if Medicare likes it, they will test it out with some level of providers and see if it works. So Medicare is also really innovative. Some of the best ideas we've had for health insurance have come from actually from Medicare, not from the private sector. So that's another myth that needs to be kind of destroyed. But yeah, as you can tell, big fan of Medicare. There's a lot there that people usually don't know about that I think if we can just bring people into Medicare, it'd become even more powerful of an engine to rein in costs and make our lives much healthier and more satisfying.
Great. So I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. How do we make Connecticut, New England, the entire country as a whole, more welcoming to people moving here from other countries in search of a better life?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's different elements of that. There's like culture. I think right now we kind of have a culture where we're really cynical of immigrants, at least certain kinds of immigrants. There's kind of times where we're more welcoming of people who look different from us, but we're definitely, I think, at a kind of a height in our country right now where we're not really that welcoming. So there's a cultural element, and a lot of that has to do with our leaders, the media, and kind of other players who disseminate information. And so I think that's one element. I think also, there are actual policy ideas that you can do to make our country more welcoming. Right now, if you come as an immigrant, the government actually provides you very little resources. A lot of it is given through charitable providers, churches, and other kind of NGOs. And so if there aren't that many in your area, it can be tough to survive and get yourself started. Or if they lose their grants or funding, it can also be, they can have really tight budgets. I think that the federal government kind of providing more to immigrants, whether they're refugees or asylum seekers, that can be really beneficial. Immigrants itself also is a huge bubble. You have immigrants who are billionaires who come in on business kind of immigrant visas. So they probably don't need too much help. Obviously you want to kind of specialize or you want to target your policy to the needs of that specific immigrant community. But those are a couple of things that I think we can do. And it's a complicated topic of how you kind of shift culture. But that's a big one.
Sure. So a couple episodes ago, I spoke to a tenant union organizer and DSA member from Central Connecticut, and he had been working on trying to keep people housed as we, kind of head towards this potential mass eviction crisis. One of the things that we talked about was the enormous disparity in Connecticut between household income in cities versus the average household income in the suburbs. What can be done about this? I know Connecticut is just about the highest state in the United States for that disparity, right? So like you look at Waterbury versus something like Farmington, and you're going to see a huge disparity. How do we close this gap?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the kind of advocacy organizations that I was working with before I launched the campaign was a group called Desegregate Connecticut. Recently launched, and as the name kind of alludes to, it's about desegregating our state. Connecticut is actually one of the most segregated states in America, even though we're kind of a liberal bubble. And there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance there around what we sometimes say and how we're willing to live our lives and how we're allowing our communities to be shaped. But a lot of this is policy-based. It's not happenstance that a lot of poor people tend to be in the same area. A lot of our local zoning policy kind of keeps people out. It does not allow poor people into those communities. So what we have now are enclaves of immense poverty and suffering. And then we have huge kind of enclaves of enormous wealth where they don't let others in. So you can do a lot by changing these zoning policies to allow public housing or affordable housing into much richer suburbs. That is something that Desegregate Connecticut is working on, is doing a phenomenal job of. So shout out to them. That's one thing that we can do. When it comes to also increasing you know, wealth and income. I think a federal jobs guarantee is essential. There's a lot of people in these areas that are unemployed. So if you don't have access to a job, or if the only job you have access to is one that really doesn't provide you much gratification or even income, you know, if you're working at your local McDonald's, or that's the only job available to you and you're really just trying to better your life, it can be really tough. But having a federal jobs guarantee, which, you know, the best way of describing it to me is saying the same way we should have a public option, or some people will say we should have public option for health insurance. We should have a public option for jobs. If your local community does not provide you with a job, if there's no jobs available, then the government should step in and provide funding to your local government and say, here's a pot of money. If somebody's looking for a job, there's probably something that your community needs to be done, and you can put them to work. That way we are becoming more productive. And I've talked to these kind of communities where they are, there's high unemployment and people want to work. You know, young people want to work, older people want to work. It's really tough for them to find jobs. Sometimes they don't have access to a car. Sometimes, you know, they have to take care of kids. There are, you know, a lot of reasons, but one idea is getting a federal jobs guarantee out there so that everyone who has the ability to work and wants to work can work, and we can get them to work and make our communities more productive. Also, improving labors and unions would, I think, help a lot of people. We kind of reduce that gap in income inequality, you know, both at the kind of the peaks where the top 1% and everyone else is facing a huge disparity, but also it would, I think, shave off the disparity between the, you know, upper middle class and kind of lower poorer population. You know, if McDonald's workers were able to unionize, I think, you know, that would probably be the most powerful way to inject money into these poorer communities. That alone, you know, Hartford probably has, 20 McDonald's. So you have, you know, probably hundreds of employees working there. Where if you did that, you would change their lives overnight, and they would be able to get benefits, higher pay, so many things that would benefit them. You know, maybe a more sustainable or more predictable work schedule where they can start planning their lives, and you know, they can actually figure out when to take their kids to the park and when they, you know, when they can do certain things. Those are just a couple of ways that we can get that done, I think.
If I may follow up on that, though, how do we do that? How do we strengthen labor unions? You know, when we have a patchwork of laws across the U.S. where some states are quote unquote right to work states, which make it a lot harder to organize a union, what would be some of your ideas to try to reinvigorate the labor movement in the U.S.?
Yeah. So there's already a great bill in Congress that just has not been passed. Given our deference to the parliamentarian, we're not able to pass the PRO Act. And the PRO Act has kind of a menu of policies that would strengthen labor unions. But I think the federal government, sometimes we forget that the federal government has immense power. And even if the state is right to work, there's a lot that the federal government can do to incentivize changes, even on the state level. You know, I'm no lawyer, so I can't, you know, get into maybe a, you know, debate of, you know, is it constitutional or is it not, but, there's a lot of stuff that we've done in the past. And I think there's a lot of stuff we can do to incentivize, changes in state laws and local laws. But yeah, there's also a lot of policy ideas. Like for instance, there's been a weakening in the ability, certain laws have made it really tough for people to sign up for unions. Before it used to be like automatically taken out of your paycheck. There's been an attempt to have laws where you have to send a check monthly or something that makes it much harder for the unions to get the money that they need to actually bargain effectively on your behalf. So there are really small things that have been done. You know, it's death by a thousand cuts type thing. So having a really powerful bill like the PRO Act pass would help get that done.
Absolutely. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me. My listeners tend to love to get engaged with campaigns. So if they want to find you and support you, how do they do that? How can they help?
Yes. So the best place to go first is our website. So the website is my last name. So www.harezi.com, and Harezi spelled H-R-E-Z-I. So if you visit our website there, you can find all the social media. So, you know, give us a follow so you can stay connected to what we're working on. One of the biggest things that we always need is contributions and investments in our movement. So think of this as, you know, if you want a brighter future, we have to fight for it. I think a lot of us, you know, it's very easy to kind of belabor a point on Twitter, but it's harder to kind of give away money or to invest your money into that movement. And so we were completely people powered and grassroots funded, no corporate money. And we've been doing a good job of building up our financial capacity. The other thing you can do is volunteer. We also have on our website, volunteer kind of a section where you can use your own abilities, or you can knock on doors if you're here in Connecticut or nearby, things of that sort. So we can always use stuff like that, or you can host a Zoom event where you introduce us to people in your network to help us expand our social circle within the campaign. So those are some ideas, but check us out. If you've got a question, you can shoot us an email. We're really always happy to connect with people who are interested in the campaign and getting some of our projects accomplished.
Well, I've interviewed close to 10 candidates since I started this podcast a little over a year ago. And every time I talk to someone like you, it just gives me hope for our future, that there are people who are willing to drop what they're doing and run for office, go through that arduous task of running in the hope of just making things better for the rest of us. So I do thank you for that as well.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I consider myself a conduit for people's frustrations. So if you're feeling it, I'm probably feeling it too. And like I said, if you feel like this resonates with you, please do invest in whatever form you can. And the only way we get this done is together. Our tagline is "Together we will." We keep it open ended. There's a lot we need to accomplish, and the only way we do it is together. So there's a lot of power in solidarity. There's a lot of power in camaraderie, and it kind of energizes me when I'm with others and having conversations like this. So thank you for hosting this podcast, and thank you to everyone who's listening. And we look forward to connecting with you all, and never lose hope. There's always a chance to better our country and our world. So let's continue fighting, I think.
Thank you.